Welcome to this podcast. I have with me Justin Bates, who is a senior barrister, called in 2003 and practicing from Arden Chambers. Justin specialises in a wide range of residential property work, particularly leaseholder issues, and regularly practices in the Leasehold Valuation Tribunal, and has written a book on leasehold disputes, A Guide to Leasehold Valuation Disputes. Justin is here today to explain various issues relevant to building insurance. Hello, Justin.
Hello. Well, thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. Justin, could I open by asking, tell me, what building insurance, why is it important?
Well, I suppose at the risk of stating the obvious, it's how you as a leaseholder can ensure that your interests are sufficiently protected. If the building gets damaged or even completely knocked down, it's going to have to be rebuilt. Insurance is the primary way of making sure that those costs are going to be recovered and provided by someone other than you, because the last thing you want as a leaseholder is to find that your building has been damaged and then get a service charge bill to pay for it. That's rather galling, I would imagine. So insurance is there to try and prevent that happening and to ensure that whatever damage is done, subject to excess and causes, etc., but in broad terms, to ensure that the damage that's done gets remedied by someone other than you. It's one of those things, it seems to me, that, as with all insurance, you hope you're never going to need it. But when you do need it, you are very, very glad that it's there. I'm sure you remember from the news a couple of weeks ago, that big block of flats up in Newcastle, where the floods up in the north had caused the underground car park to wash away, and all the foundations are now washing away. And I can well imagine that the leaseholders in those flats are very grateful for the insurance, because if nothing else, it means that hopefully they don't have to pay to rebuild their own building. So I think that's the main reason why it's there. I mean, it's also got wider points, as you'll know from your days in practice, that mortgage companies generally want it there to make sure their interest is protected. They're rather reluctant to lend against property that isn't or can't be insured. And unless you happen to have large amounts of money sitting around, most of us need a mortgage to buy a property. So if it's not insured or can't be insured, you're going to have problems there. And then it just ties in with all the additional expenses that would come with doing those sorts of work. So insurance policies often include things like alternative accommodation costs. If you're going to be out for a year, you want to make sure that someone is going to provide you with accommodation in the meantime. Again, you don't particularly want to be having to rent accommodation whilst paying to rebuild your own property. So it's very much there to protect the leaseholder's interest and to protect the value of their investment. I would say anyway. It also protects landlords. Let's not beat around the bush. Landlords don't want to see that their reversion damaged either. But my view is it's primarily a tenant benefit.
Right. What if a leaseholder should find out that his building isn't insured?
If he finds out his building isn't insured, other than needing to sit down and probably pour himself a stiff drink, there's nothing to stop you insuring the building yourself. And subject to funds, that would normally be my immediate reaction, because you don't want to leave it uninsured. You'll probably also find it's a breach of your mortgage conditions. You've got two slightly longer-term remedies than that, I would have thought. One is, in most leases, it will be an obligation for the landlord to insure and to recover the costs via the service charge. If he's not taking out insurance, you would be entitled to issue your claim for a mandatory injunction, go off to the county court, get an order compelling him to take out insurance. That's probably the less attractive of the two remedies. My other view, my other remedy, and the one I think more likely, is I'd go off to the LVT and have him appoint a manager. As I'm sure you know, but as the readers, the listeners, sorry, may not, the Landlord and Tenant Act 1987 gives the LVT a power that used to be the High Court's power to appoint a manager and or someone with the functions of a receiver over the property. He effectively takes over the running of the property. The LVT, in my experience, takes insurance issues very seriously, and rightly, to my mind, and a landlord who was, I would say, more than once not getting his insurance on the line would be at risk having a manager appointed and having his whole management function for that building taken away. That's probably what I would do if we were having this problem again and again. I don't know if you've got any other views on it, other advice at least tend to give in that situation.
Well, certainly it's we do find ourselves advising on seeking the appointment manager quite a bit. Mm. Although there is a remedy available of right to manage, one reason or another it may not be possible, it may be a quicker remedy, but we do find ourselves recommending appointment of a manager in all sorts of situations, which may well include lack of insurance.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't see myself recommending right to manage just because someone wasn't having the insurance in place. It'll take too long. You need something done immediately. That's why I say the options, it seems to me, are do it yourself or issue an urgent application, have the LVT decide on possibly an interim manager appointment to get it sorted out. I mean, I've done an interim manager case this year. We got it in 3 days after we issued. Now, 3 days is a long time if something goes wrong in those 3 days, but it's quicker than any other remedy you're going to get. Much quicker than the county court. Certainly much quicker than right to manage.
Great. Thanks very much.
So that's all right. No, that's all right. So that's why I think it's important. I suppose I suspect, you can tell me if I'm wrong on this, I suspect you get most questions from people wanting to find out a bit more about what their insurance is, though. They sort of presume it's there.
How would they go about getting information? Are there various ways of doing that?
There are. The schedule for the Landlord and Tenant Act 1985 is where you want to be on this. The schedule is designed to deal entirely with insurance-related disputes. So the schedule's got three sort of general rights in there. The first is that the leaseholder has the right to obtain a summary of insurance cover. I think this is paragraph 2 of the schedule, which gives you the landlord has to give you the name of the insurer, the list of the insured risks, list of the insured amounts. In practice, landlords will normally just give you a copy of the policy as a whole, because that's automatically complying with their obligations under it. So you start off, it seems to me, by writing a letter saying, pursuant to the schedule of the 1985 Act, please could I have a summary of my insurance cover? And I would suspect you'd get back a copy of the insurance policy. You've also got a right to inspect the policy and all its associated documents. And that associated documents is very interesting, because that's accounts, receipts, everything that goes to the wider issue of insurance. So if you want to see that how much the landlord's paid out, for example, you can see, you're entitled to see what's gone out of certain bank accounts to see where the money's gone. That's paragraph 3, I think, of the schedule. Given that you've got a right to inspect the actual policy and the associated documents, I personally don't see what the point of giving you a right to obtain a summary of cover was, because why anyone would ever go and ask for a summary when they've got the right to the whole thing is beyond me. But those are your two primary rights there. And as I say, I think in reality it's the right to inspect the policy and the associated documents. And before going off on any sort of insurance-related dispute with my landlord, that's what I want to start with. Because from that, hopefully, it will give me the information I need to see if there's anything to the other kinds of dispute I'm going to have. So one thing I know we're going to talk about a bit later on is commissions, and whether what's lawful about them, what's unlawful about them. I would generally, if I was going to have a dispute with my landlord, want to know if a commission is being paid, and I would ask to inspect the policy and all the associated documents to see what money flowed from who to who in this matter. It's also a very good way of checking that the landlord's doing what he's supposed to do under the terms of the lease. In case you and I were discussing by email a couple of days ago, the Green and 180 Archway Road case, Upper Tribunal, July of this year. A very interesting insurance case, and just one just worth noting in here. As I remember it, the lease provided for the landlord to insure in the names of the landlord and the tenant, so as to ensure that everyone's interest is noted on the policy. And the landlord hadn't been doing that, or it's not for all years. Some years he has, some years he hasn't. Some years it was just his interest and a general clause that there may be other people who have interest in the buildings. Some years he's done it properly. Having managed to get hold of all the insurance documents in each year, Miss Green was able to show that he hadn't done it in compliance with the terms of the lease each year. And perhaps slightly surprisingly, although probably correctly, when for the years where she was able to show that he hadn't been insuring in accordance with the terms of the lease, the Upper Tribunal said no service charge was payable in respect of the insurance.
Amazing.
So Miss Green got a bit of a windfall there.
You've got all these rights, you can get a summary or a policy or associated documents and receipts. Well, what if the landlord says no, you can't have them?
Well, this is the problem, and this is a problem that comes with various bits of tenants' rights legislation. It's criminal sanction, punishable by a fine in the magistrate's court. And this is where it just, frankly, it gets a bit of a mockery here. The number of local authorities, because it's they who are supposed to enforce this, the number of local authorities who are prepared to take action here is tiny. I've been doing this for around 10 years. I've had one local authority minded to prosecute a client of mine. It wasn't actually over insurance, it was over another similar related provision. But I know of one, talking to colleagues and friends who practice in this area, I don't think anyone's been involved in more than two or three. I'd just be amazed if there's much enforcement work there. And it's a problem, and Parliament, frankly, should step in and come up with a better kind of remedy. But on the face of it, that's your right. Your right is, I'm afraid, to complain to the authorities who could prosecute someone. In reality, it seems to me that if you can show I've been asking for these rights, and you have the right to these documents. I've been asking my landlord for them. He's been ignoring me, or he's been telling me not to. Just telling me he hasn't got them, or he won't give them to me, whatever it's going to be. In reality, if you then issue your LVT claim, I suspect the LVT is going to be very sympathetic to an order that he has to disclose them almost before you do anything else. Now, the LVT shouldn't normally go off on fishing expeditions like that, but it seems to me it's a very different situation where you say, I've been asking and asking and asking for this, and he won't give it to me. And I suspect they would order him to provide it. If he doesn't, then at trial the LVT is going to draw the appropriate inference, and the usual inference that you draw from someone refusing to provide a document is there's something wrong with it. So it's normally taken against the party not disclosing.
Interesting. So suppose there's been some damage and you could put a claim on the insurance. Can a leaseholder make the claim themselves?
It's not so much they can make the claim themselves. Although they could do if they're interested to protect it under the policy. But the statutory right in the Schedule to the 85 Act is the right to notify the insurer of the claim. You've got a right, effectively, to ring your insurance company up and say, hi, I know you insure my building. I am notifying you that there has been this particular damage, and that a claim should be made. That's your right in that regard, and the usual process should then happen, loss adjusters, etc., etc. I would hope, although you may tell me differently, I would hope it would be a comparatively rare case where a landlord would refuse to put a claim through the insurance provisions. It's hard to see why you'd recommend that to a landlord, I have to say, because he's going to have a nasty service charge fight if he's not careful.
Yeah.
But you have the right to ring up the insurance company, or write to them, or email them, or tweet at them if you see fit, to tell them about the claim. And that, again, is in the 85 Act, the schedule to the 85 Act.
Great. Now, I suppose I get a bill. I've got to pay towards these insurance premiums. Do I just have to write out the cheque, you know, whatever figure is put forward?
No, presuming for a moment that the service charge premium is recoverable the insurance premium is recoverable as a service charge, which is probably the case in most situations. So the landlord tucked away in Schedule 4 of the lease has got all these things he has to do and he can charge for as a service charge and normally insure the building is one of them in there. That's your vanilla or standard situation. So you get a service charge bill, some of that money will be for insurance, and it will be in respect of the premium. You don't have to pay it. Or rather, you have two grounds of challenging it seems to me. The first is, of course, as in all situations, the landlord can only charge for something that's provided for in the lease. And that's the Green and Archway Road case to come back to again, providing something that wasn't what the lease provided for. So if it's not in the lease, you don't have to pay for it. It's vanishingly rare, I would have thought, that a lease will not make any provision for insurance. So I would usually start on the basis that there is likely to be something about me having to pay insurance charges in there. I think what it really comes down to is your Section 19 rights. Section 19 of the Landlord Tenant Act 1935, as you know, and as I'm sure that the listeners do, provides that leaseholders only have to pay service charges to the extent they're reasonably incurred and that they're reasonable in their amount. Reasonably incurred, I would generally expect an insurance premium to be reasonably incurred. You generally need insurance. I wouldn't necessarily accept that all elements of it are reasonably incurred. And I know we'll talk a little bit later about, for example, terrorism and commission charges. But in principle, I would expect an insurance premium to be reasonably incurred. The other element of it, of course, is it's got to be reasonable in its amount, which in very general terms is a value for money test. So, if the leaseholder can show that there's something excessive or unreasonable about the cost of the policy, that's a basis for knocking the charge down. And it might be that it's excessive or unreasonable because you insure too much. It might be that the rebuild value is too high. It might be that the landlord doesn't really take proper steps to test the market. We'll talk about some of these, I know, in a little bit more detail thereon. But those are your two main protections. Is it provided for in the lease? Is it reasonably incurred and reasonable in its amount? And you only have to pay any service charge to the extent that it's provided for in the lease and reasonably incurred and reasonable in its amount.
One of the issues that often comes across my desk as a leasehold advisor is about the scope of cover. Mm. Is it over-insured? I suppose terrorism insurance is one of those obvious issues as well.
Well, terrorism insurance is a big one. I mean, that I suspect if we were having this conversation 15 years ago, this wouldn't figure at all. But it just seems, certainly from my experience, to become a much more important issue. It's a very difficult one. It's very fact-sensitive. There are certain buildings where you would generally expect there to be a need for terrorism insurance. I would imagine, my hometown, for example, is Cheltenham. Cheltenham has GCHQ, the government spy headquarters there. It seems to me not to be fanciful to suggest that if there was going to be a terrorist attack in the UK, blowing up GCHQ would be an option. And I could imagine that if I had one of the blocks of flats next to GCHQ, I would probably want terrorism insurance. If, however, I have a flat in the middle of Bodmin Moor, it may be that there's less of a reason to have terrorism insurance there. It's a very fact-sensitive one. What I would say is the RICS code does suggest that landlords should certainly look at getting terrorism insurance. And I think that's probably right. It seems to me that it's one, whether you want it or not, or whether you need it or not, whether it's reasonable, to put it most importantly, is going to be a very fact-sensitive situation. And in general terms, I would expect major cities or those that are close to important national assets to want terrorism insurance and those that are more remote not to. I certainly wouldn't ever recommend doing away with it completely. I wouldn't want to live next to the MI6 building and not have terrorism insurance. I wouldn't want to live, frankly, in much of Zone 1 of central London without terrorism insurance. I wouldn't want to live next to major liquid gas pipelines, let's say, without terrorism insurance. I don't want to send the listeners running off thinking, oh my goodness, what things could blow up near me. But it's one to look at in the round and look at carefully. I wouldn't rule it out, but I think it's certainly true to say that it's being found in more places than I would initially have expected to find it.
Okay. You mentioned the RICS code. Could you sort of tell us in passing what it is?
Yeah, the Secretary of State has a power in Section 87 of the Leasehold Reform Housing and Urban Development Act 1993 to specify codes of practice, professional codes of practice, that are regarded as not just best practice, but also things LVTs and courts should take into account when looking at how service charge functions are being discharged. And in England, the Secretary of State's done two of them. He's done the RICS Code, Blue Book, second edition, and he's done the Association of Retirement Housing Managers Code. It's slightly different in Wales. From memory, the Welsh have got, I think their retirement one is different from memory.
Yeah. I have a feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a second edition came in about 3 years ago in England, but it didn't come in Wales.
I think that's right. Like, I confess, I haven't had to look at this for a while, but I know it is slightly different in Wales, so you just need to check.
Yeah.
Check if the Welsh Assembly passed the statutory instrument updating it or not.
Yeah.
But certainly in England, it's the second edition RICS one. It's the Blue Book. It's about £35 from the RICS website. And the Association of Retirement Housing Managers, theirs is free and available to download on their website. And they're effectively best practice guides. They're the kind of things that I would expect and hope to find in every managing agent's office, well-thumbed and well-loved. And if you're a leaseholder putting together a challenge, wanting to know what your rights are, they're excellent books because they're setting out what should be expected of the people you're paying for.
And well-thumbed in our office as well.
And well-thumbed in your office as well, yes. So
okay.
So in parentheses, that's what the RICS code is.
Okay. I mean, one of the big issues that often comes up is commissions. Tell us a little about commissions how it's approached.
Commissions are probably, I would say, the biggest single issue in insurance-related LVT disputes at the moment. It's I'm going to try and take a relatively neutral approach to it, because there's a lot of LVT cases out there, but there's one big High Court case that's the important one. Frequently, a landlord will place an insurance policy for his block of flats or for his portfolio of flats, and he will get money back from the insurance company. And these are commonly referred to as a commission. Now, if you're a leaseholder, your immediate response is likely to be, well, hang on, if I paid £100 for my insurance and the landlord gets £10 of it back, doesn't that suggest that £90 was only the right amount to pay for my insurance? And what you end up with is a case called Williams and Southwark in the High Court. And this is the really important one. Southwark went out to insure all of their properties. There's various insurance policies in there, but in broad terms, Southwark were getting a commission back from their insurer. The one that ended up in Williams and Southwark, they were getting 25% back. 5% of it was effectively a loyalty bonus. It was thank you for placing the insurance with us. And 20% of it was paying Southwark for things that Southwark staff would have to do on behalf of the insurance company. And Williams challenged it. Southwark conceded the 5% and said, yeah, we can't defend that. We're not doing anything for it. And the High Court said, that's quite right, you should have conceded that. It's a correct concession. Because it cannot be that you make a profit off these things. You're not doing anything for the money. But on the remaining 20%, Southwark said, well, look, we have to do the claims history, the claims handling, the valuation, whatever it's going to be. And for this, we receive a fee. If we didn't receive a fee, we'd charge. And so effectively what we're doing is we're being paid in lieu of charging as and when things arrive, we're getting paid a fee to represent the work we are doing or likely to do or could be called upon to do. And the High Court said, well, in principle, that's fine, subject to the fact it's got to be value for money in the usual way, and it has to be a realistic payment. In principle, money going from an insurance company to a landlord is okay, so long as it truly relates to those services being rendered. And drawing that distinction can be quite difficult. There are LVT cases where LVTs have found commissions as high as 40%. And without giving any secrets away, one imagines it's quite difficult to justify receiving that sort of money back from a landlord on the Williams and Southwark test. Because it's hard to see how you could be doing that amount of work to get all that money back. You might, and the landlord may be able to justify it on the facts, but in broad terms, that sort of level is quite high. The LVTs, in general terms, tend to take the view that somewhere in the 12 to 15, possibly as high as 20, is acceptable. But it comes down to the facts of each case and what the landlord says he's doing for the money. If he can't show he's doing something for the money, he's in difficulties. And there may well be problems about the level of commission that he's receiving, and the LVT may well take the view it's unearned profit rather than a true payment for services rendered. So, I mean, if there are any landlords listening to this, the key thing you need to be able to do is explain what you do for your money. For tenants, it's exactly that point. It's drawing the distinction between what would be a fair fee for what they do and an unfair fee. You don't have to pay, as a tenant, more than is reasonable. It cannot be reasonable for you to subsidise via the service charge a landlord making a profit. So that's the broad fight. The principles are quite easy to understand, but playing it out in each case is always a factual dispute. So it's trying to find, it seems to me, in each case where that boundary lies. For tenants, if you're going to run a challenge on this basis, it seems to me to be very important to get true comparators and like-for-like quotes, so you can make the point to the LVT, well, that can't be right. It can't be that we're paying for all this, because look, we could get someone else to do exactly the same for much less. So there must be something unreasonable about this. Whilst generally, as you know, and I'm sure all the listeners do, generally reasonable doesn't mean a race to the bottom. If you can show that the market range is generally about, let's say, £1,000 for your building, and the landlord's charging £2,000, something's gone wrong there. And I would strongly suspect it'll be that he's receiving more money back than can be justified on what he's doing for it. So, I mean, that's the basic distinction. As I say, in each case, it's trying to play it out to understand how it all relates to the facts of any individual case.
Right. It's interesting. Certainly, it's an area that we get a lot of questions about. Another thing that comes up a lot is you can get a policy that covers many buildings. Mm. I mean, it's certainly the case with local authorities, and I've seen it in private landlords as well. And I wonder if there are any particular issues that listeners should be made aware of, and what are called portfolio policies.
Well, local authorities I'd put slightly to one side, because they often self-insure, of course, as it's sometimes called.
And allowed to.
And are allowed to, for various reasons. They're often treated slightly differently. But certainly in the private sector, portfolio insurance policies are very, very common. And they can work to the lessee's advantage. I don't want it to be thought they're a bad thing. It might well be that, for example, you as a lessee live in a hard-to-insure block. It could be that there's a flooding risk, or the lead's always being stolen off the roof, or there's a history of antisocial behaviour. And if you took that one block to the market would either decline to insure it, or would quote such outrageous policies or such outrageous exclusions that you'd never get insured. And so a block portfolio policy may be, frankly, in some cases, the only way you can get insured. The listeners will immediately have grasped, of course, if there's some people who benefit from it, there must be some who lose out, because a portfolio policy where you do the entirety of your stock, there'll be some blameless, perfectly run properties that never have any problems, which in practice end up subsidising the harder to run properties. And that's where it gets very difficult, because in general terms, the LVT isn't too keen on that sort of cross-subsidy, because they make the point with some justification, it seems to me, it's not really about what the landlord does. You've got to remember, this is other people's money. It's the tenant's money being taken here. And why should the tenant of Block A be subsidising the tenant, not just of Block B and C on his estate, but of Block W 400 miles away? So it can be a very difficult one that way. If you think you are one of the good estates being effectively overcharged, again, you need to get the true comparative quote to try and show this is the case. Looking at what could you get if you just took this building to market. What I would say in this, just as a general bit of tip, is general tip here, it does have to be a true like-for-like quote. You shouldn't go and get, or rather it won't help you as much in the LVT, if you go and get a quote that isn't comparable with what the landlord is providing. So if the landlord only has a £500 excess, let's say, you need to get quotes on the same basis. If the landlord has disclosed to the insurance company this building has a particularly bad claims history, you need to do so on the same basis. Reasonableness does not mean, has never meant, and there is no prospect at all of the case law ever being interpreted to mean, a race to the bottom. It means a fair price in the market, and in judging that fair price, you need to do the true like-for-like quote. So the portfolios can go one of two ways, as I say. It depends if you're the loser or the winners on it. It's a very difficult one. The bigger criticism, I think, tends to be that not all landlords take their portfolios to market often enough. They tend to pick and choose individual properties within there. And there is some quite interesting LVT case law. It's only LVT, nothing's got any higher, on how often landlords should take their portfolio to market and what kind of property in the portfolio they should take. If you're going after a portfolio policy, I would probably say, come in and talk to the guys at Lease about it, because there are certain specific tactical considerations you'll want to take on board.
Yeah, right. I have many people come to me, particularly if they're living in sort of South Wales or the North or the Midlands, who they've got a house, they've owned it for many years, they might have inherited it, and they find out that it's on a leasehold. And it may well be that they're paying there's a nominal pittance, a guinea ground rent on a 999-year lease. And they don't realise they've got a leasehold until maybe the freehold has changed hands. And it's not just flats that are on leasehold. There's still a fair number of leasehold houses. Mm. And there are also insurance issues. People think they own a house and that they're captain of their own fate or master of their own destiny when you own a house, and you're not. Because if you've got a leasehold house, you may well be beholden to a freeholder who may be some distance away on a number of issues, particularly insurance. Justin, could you explain to us some of the insurance issues arising from leasehold houses?
Yes, of course. Before 2005, you were probably in quite an invidious position. The particular position of leasehold houses got its own statutory amendments in the 2002 Act, coming into force on the 28th of February 2005 in England and 31st of May 2005 in Wales, just need to watch some of these, but I should just say, a lot of this stuff has different dates depending upon whether you're in England or Wales or not, so you need to just check the commencement dates carefully. Tenants, leaseholders of houses are often required to insure with someone nominated or approved by the landlord. And it was to address that problem that Section 164 of the 2002 Act, the Common Hold and Leasehold Reform Act 2002, was brought into force. In general terms, I mean, as you might imagine, there's quite a lot of detail to it, and I'm trying to give you an overview of it here. In general terms, where you've got a house that you're required to insure with someone nominated or approved by the landlord, you've now got the right, effectively, to ignore that clause in your lease and to insure with anyone that you see fit. There are certain procedures you have to go through. It has to be, again, like-for-like insurance. You have to note everyone's interests carefully. And in broad terms, it depends upon you serving documents on the landlord to tell him what you're doing. Given how important this is, I'd always serve those kinds of things by recorded delivery and such like. But in general terms, if you own a leasehold house, subject to giving him the relevant notice and buying a policy that complies with the conditions in the Act, you are at liberty to choose who you insure with, and you don't have to go down the landlord's route. I don't myself know how often this is used, because it's not the kind of thing that would come across my desk, because it's hard to see how it gets into a dispute very often. Certainly doesn't end up in the LVT as a dispute. I imagine it's mostly dealt with at an advisory level, which is fitting with what you were saying, Nicholas, about people coming in. So if you've got a leasehold house, you, in some respects, have better rights than leaseholders of flats in large dwellings. 164 2002 Act is the one you want to go and look at, and just making sure that the policy you buy meets the various conditions that are specified in there. The other option you've got as a house, very underused provision, Section 40, Landlord Tenant Act 1987, 40, which gives you the right to apply to the LVT to vary the lease in respect of the insurance. If the insurance provisions in the lease are unsatisfactory, with regard to any matter relating to the insurance of the dwelling, then you can apply to the LVT to vary the lease. Any matter relating to the insurance of the dwelling seems to me to be very, very broad, and I would be surprised if the LVT didn't interpret it in a similarly broad approach. So if you've got a problem that can't be remedied by just going off and getting your own insurance, Section 40 seems to provide you with a way to get in front of the LVT and say, look, here is this problem. Let's say, for example, I am required under my lease to insure with Joe Bloggs Insurance Company, but they went out of business 40 years ago. So how on earth do I comply with this covenant? Section 40 would give the LVT a power to say, we're deleting Joe Bloggs Insurance Co. from the lease, and we insert the phrase, any insurance company of repute, which is the normal modern way of doing it. So Eagle Star, Lloyds, whoever you want to go with, someone big and in the marketplace. Again, Section 40 doesn't seem to get used very much. Very, very few LVT cases on it. So far as I'm aware, nothing from a higher court or tribunal. It may be that leasehold houses just muddle through. I think that less likely than people just don't know the right exists.
Well, I do get people asking me about insurance, and then I do end my advice by saying, tell me when you brought it, that house. And if you brought it, or owned it for more than 2 years, you do have a right to buy the freehold, and it may well be at a low price. So, I mean, that's the ultimate solution.
So you go down the 67 Act route and just buy the freehold Act, which would obviously be a very good way of dealing with that. Yes, that may be the reason it doesn't come anywhere. Although you are seeing a lot of leasehold houses being built now on some of the newer build estates.
Exactly, I have. I've seen a number of those.
I mean, I've got a couple sitting on my desk at the moment. They're 999-year leases of leasehold houses. So trying to buy that under the 1967 Act is going to be ruinously expensive. So I wonder if there's going to be a new generation of leasehold houses needing to think about their insurance rights.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, thanks very much, Justin.
No, not at all. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for your very, very informative explanation of various rights that pertain to building insurance issues, and I'd like to thank the listeners for attending to this podcast
and for their patience, if nothing else.
Right, and please do have a look at our website. I particularly recommend our booklet Service Charges and Other Issues, an application to a leasehold valuation tribunal, which touch on insurance, and we do have on our website a number of leasehold valuation tribunal decisions going back many, many years. Thanks very much, Justin.
Thanks a lot.